Hello, 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 and thank you for tuning in. We're going to begin today's episode with a bit of song.
A goodie.
I hear the distant thunder hum, Maryland, my Maryland, the old line bugle, fife and drum, Maryland, my Maryland, she is not dead, nor deaf, nor dumb. Huzzah, she spurns the northern scum. She breathes, she burns, she'll come Maryland, my Maryland.
What you just heard, friends and neighbors, is an excerpt from one of the most famous songs in Maryland's history. Hello, I'm Ben.
Oh, I'm Noel. What was it that gave it away? Was it the Oh Maryland, Oh Maryland?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we only played a part of that song, but trust us, that sick hook comes into play multiple times.
Well, it starts off, you know, innocently enough as a nice rollicking, if derivative tune. What's that tune, Ben? I can't quite put my finger on it.
I'm pretty sure we both know it's O Tannenbaum.
Vaguely holiday-centric. Yeah, okay, I was being coy. But right, starts off innocently enough, lyrically speaking. And then the part we play, things take a bit of a turn, don't they, Ben?
They do, and we also hope this amuses our estranged super producer, Casey Pegram, whom we promise is still out and about, but will come in from the cold very soon. Noel, should we read that last verse for anyone who didn't get it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those big booming, you know, swingle singer type voices could have obscured some meaning there.
Mm-hmm. So they're saying, I hear the distant thunder hum, Maryland, the old line bugle, fife and drum, Maryland. So far, so good.
Fine.
Yeah. She is not dead, nor deaf, nor dumb.
Mm.
Huzzah, she spurns the northern scum.
Oh, wait, what?
She breathes, she burns, she'll come, Maryland, my Maryland!
Oh, man, they're really into Maryland. But I'm sorry, the northern scum?
Yes, yes, indeed, my friend, the northern scum. You see, the song that was, for a long time, the state song of Maryland turned out to be belligerent to other states in the fair union of the U.S.
But Ben, why would they do that?
I'm so glad that we asked this question today, because it's one of those historical footnotes that everyone would just accept as normal. Let's face it, many people here in the U.S. don't pay that much attention to the song of a particular state.
Yeah, I think ours is Georgia on my mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of rare to have something of a modern song, like what you would consider a pop-type song as your state song. Typically, they're more classic, folky-type songs, right?
Mm-hmm. And as you said, they're also occasionally plagiarized in terms of melody.
Well, you know, there's only so many melodies.
There are only so many notes to go around. And the lyrics to this song, which you can find in full with a little bit of Google foo, or which we might post on Ridiculous Historians when this episode comes out.
I'm more into Google Quando myself.
Yeah, you're a Google Quando.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about the grapple?
Yeah. Sweep the leg. I don't know about any of this stuff, man. I'm just just spitballing here. But here's a little passage in the tune that really makes us think, and this is what kind of got us to dig into a little bit more background here. Avenge the patriotic gore that flecked the streets of Baltimore, and be the battle queen of your Maryland, my Maryland. Kind of this personification of Maryland as being some sort of badass avenging warrior, right? And what are these gore-flecked streets of Baltimore referenced here?
Right, and right before we get to that, I just want to establish what I was saying. We'll go ahead. I'll do it. We'll post these lyrics in full because you really should read along with them if you can to see this. There's a lot of allusion and reference in this, and you're absolutely right, Noel. There's something more to the story here when we see this personification of Maryland as a heroic protector of downtrodden people, and it traces back to a real-life event. Isn't that correct? One that occurred in 1861.
A real-life event indeed. And it's something – it really drew attention to something that I was unaware of. I think Maryland, and I think Northern. I think Maryland is right next to New York. I think it's like got the same sensibilities and historical leanings. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, not the case.
No, yeah, that's a mid-Atlantic state, but during the time of the Civil War and for a lot of time during the formation of what would later become recognized as the modern U.S.,
sure.
Maryland was considered a southern state, very much so.
Yeah.
Both geographically and culturally.
Yeah, ideologically as well, right?
Yes, because Maryland, you see, had a lot of tobacco, and as a result, they were a slave state for some time.
So, Ben, let's get back to those gore-speckled streets of Baltimore, which is pretty dope to rhyme gore and Baltimore.
Yes, let us travel there. The gore-soaked streets in question are themselves in Baltimore, specifically a street called Pratt Street, P-R-A-T-T. On April 19th in 1861, on Pratt Street in Baltimore, there was a conflict that it led to a riot, or what some would call a massacre, between two ideologically opposed groups in the city.
That's right. Honest Abe Lincoln, the president, you might have heard of him, was not the most popular guy. He actually had a nickname that I only just recently discovered, the Rail Splitter. Mm-hmm. You know about this?
I've heard about this.
Yeah, I guess because...
What's the full story?
Well, I guess it's... I can only assume it means because he divided the country.
Oh, yep, there's that.
Yeah, so that's what happened, right? You had, like, the Union versus the Confederacy, Confederacy being the pro-slave states that wanted to secede from the Union, and then you had the primarily Northern Union states and the Union Army. Lincoln called for a rallying of troops to protect the capital in Washington, D.C. after the bombarding of Fort Sumter in, is it Charleston? Charleston, South Carolina, I believe, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, and which apparently wasn't of particular military strategic value to the North, but it became this kind of symbol of Union forces that to the point where it was symbolically, I suppose, attacked by Confederate forces. And that is when the Civil War really kicked off.
Yeah, the first shots of the war that occurs in the first battle of Fort Sumter on April 12th. 1861. And so Lincoln, as we said, needs to protect D.C., and he orders a ton of troops to go to the Capitol and prepare for war with the southern states who are seceding from the Union. A lot of these troops were brought through a major transportation hub at the time, Baltimore City. But there was a problem, because in Maryland, there were tons and tons of people who, even if they were, you know, generally anti-war, they were sympathetic with the Confederate side.
To secession, to this idea they should be allowed to do that if they so chose.
Yeah.
And they really resented this notion of Union troops passing through their city. They saw it as intimidation in some form, or even the idea that they would be there to prevent them from seceding if they wanted to, and to, you know, try to hold them at gunpoint in the Union.
Right, yeah, and that's a fact that we can't gloss over, because you can imagine how easily people could perceive it that way. Even if it is not intended to be a show of force, it comes across as one, and there's no way around it. This leads to simmering, unsustainable tension. Because there were two sides. There were people who were out-and-out Confederate sympathizers saying we should join with what we see as the good cause, the right to secede. Mm-hmm. And then there were other people who were saying we object to waging a war against our states to the south, our southern neighbors, whether or not we agree with their aims.
Right, and whether or not this gentleman, Baltimore Mayor George W. Brown, personally agreed with those aims isn't clear from what I've read, but what he knew was that it wasn't going to go particularly well if these Union soldiers marched through his city. And so he actually wrote a letter of warning to Abe Lincoln, and it went as such. The people are exasperated to the highest degree by the passage of troops, and the citizens are universally decided in the opinion that no more should be ordered to come. The authorities did their best to protect both strangers and citizens and to prevent a collision, but in vain. It is my solemn duty to inform you that it is not possible for more soldiers to pass through Baltimore unless they fight their way at every step. So there had already been a trickle of forces going through because, as we said, there was this railroad hub. They had to switch lines to Camden Station, which was a mile and a half west of the PW&B depot where they would get off and march through the city to the other line and then make their way directly to Washington, D.C. So there had clearly already been some tensions in the streets during previous passings through of these forces, and the mayor was really trying his best to keep these tensions at a simmer rather than boiling over.
To keep an increasingly fragile peace. Unfortunately, his efforts, as well-intentioned as they were in vain. And as Union troops came through Baltimore on their way south in April of 1861, they were attacked by mobs. And Union troops, as well as Baltimore residents, civilians, mind you, were killed in these riots.
Yeah, this gets super hairy, super quick. There's another story, too, involving travel on this line. Lincoln himself had to pass through this area under cover of night because of the Union sympathizers there and fear that there would be an attempt on his life. So there was actually like a political cartoon that was circulating of Abe Lincoln kind of sheepishly peeking out of a boxcar as though he were, you know, a thief in the night kind of. So, yeah, Lincoln had only won, I think, something in the neighborhood of 3% of the vote in Baltimore during the election. So not a well-liked guy. But similarly to the Lincoln story, at first no one knew that there were troops on this train that was coming through. It looked like any other freight train.
Right. The arrival of the soldiers was largely not registered by the civilians, the people just walking around in Baltimore, but rumors started spreading very quickly. And again, as we said, there was that, 3% approval rating you mentioned?
Not so good.
Not good at all. And the residents and the local community leaders absolutely, publicly disliked the new administration of the Union. And when they found out that the soldiers, specifically volunteers from the 6th Massachusetts, I believe, when they found out they were in the city, that they were about to make the transfer to Camden, they were doing this in daylight. And there was a relatively short distance for them, right? It was, it's like they go 4 blocks north, 2 blocks south. Like we have the blocks mapped out. And this short distance is where everything hits the fan, historically speaking, because the Baltimoreans are already very sensitive. These rumors are becoming increasingly believable to the average citizen. Railroad officials already anticipate that there could be trouble, and if trouble occurs, it will occur in this switch.
Did you know that during that switch, they would literally unhook the train cars from the track and pull them through town
with horses? Yeah.
That's wild. So that was happening,
yes,
right, with these soldiers. And it kind of ended up like a, you know, Wild West wagon train shootout because even before this crazy decoupling situation happens, the soldiers were noticed.
Yeah, the soldiers were noticed, and the soldiers themselves from Massachusetts were prepared because the commander, Colonel Edward Jones, had received these warnings from railroad officials. So they were ready for a situation to go sideways, to go pear-shaped, or, appropriate for this episode, for things to go south. So imagine the tension in the inside these cars. These guys are sitting ducks. They know, their commander knows, that if something is going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong in this fateful passage between railroad stations. So inside the cars, the soldiers are literally trying not to look out of the windows because just like the beginning maybe of a zombie film, you mentioned Wild West. To me, it feels like a zombie thing where you see one straggler approach,
right,
and then more and then more and then more, because workers and residents of the area start following the line of cars, which is, I believe, about 7 cars long at this time.
That is correct. And they were pulled by horses down Pratt Street heading towards this Camden station. And the crowd gets bigger and bigger and more unruly. People are shouting, "Jeff Davis," mm-hmm. as in Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm. And as this simmer grows into a roiling boil, all of a sudden something snaps. People start throwing stones at the very last coach.
Like big old paving stones.
Yeah, yeah, not pebbles.
Things. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And some of them were armed mm-hmm. with pistols. I think someone got their thumb blasted off, bleeding out in the streets there. People were getting hit. So all of the cars, except for 2, got to where they needed to go. But these mobsters, I'm going to call them, were doing stuff like they were throwing obstacles in the road, like anvils.
And sand and anchors.
Sand and just, I mean, they were ready, I guess, mm-hmm. right? This is crazy. And so the cars that were remaining that were blocked, the soldiers had to get off.
And again, we have to emphasize that they had no sympathizers in the crowd on their side.
Sure didn't seem like it.
Yeah, there was nobody standing by moving anchors away from the road.
No.
In fact, there was a businessman named Charles Pendergast who supplied people with crowbars and pickaxes and said, and convinced them, not that it took much arm twisting, convinced them to pull the rails up from the street, because the paved streets, we should mention, had rails to make it easier for the horses to pull the cars.
Exactly. So let's just clarify real quick. So this first onslaught on these troops came while they were still in the cars, right?
Right.
They were trying their damnedest not to make eye contact with the zombie weirdos that were outside that you mentioned earlier. But then, of course, they unleashed hell on these cars, started literally firing upon them and throwing paving stones, like I said, through it. And a guy got his thumb blown off. And that was when he asked Major Benjamin Watson, who was in this car with him, for permission to fire on the crowd. And he granted this permission. And so they were able to kind of shoot up and away, a volley of shots.
Yeah, through the windows,
yeah.
Meaning to disperse the crowd.
Kind of not a warning shot.
Yeah,
right.
Not to hurt anyone.
Not directly to kill. And that was enough to get them a little bit more freedom where they could kind of proceed.
For a second.
For a minute.
Yeah, because after not much time had passed, this began to turn into a full-on gun battle, and the rails were successfully pulled from the pavement. So there wasn't a way for the horses to continue pulling the cars. And this means that the stranded soldiers have to do something incredibly dangerous, a last resort. Over 200 of them have to get out of the cars in gunfire,
yeah,
and walk their unlucky keisters to the train station.
Yeah, and they formed sort of a phalanx, like a formation, and in the hopes that they could keep these rioters at bay. I do want to read a pretty cool quote from this article on HistoryNet about this particular event called Baltimore Riot of 1861. In this car, the major gives kind of a pep talk where he says that you will likely be called horrible names. People will throw things at you. People will do anything they can to mess with you. And he uses the term, even if they throw stones, bricks, or other missiles at you, just don't look at them. Don't pay them any mind. But if you're fired upon and any one of you is hit, your officers will order you to fire. Do not fire into any promiscuous crowds, but select any man whom you may see aiming at you and be sure you drop him.
So don't hurt anyone who is just standing with the crowd
right.
protesting.
Yes.
But if someone is aiming to do possibly fatal damage.
Yeah.
Take him out.
So now this has come to pass. This was earlier. Yeah. This was them kind of like preparing for what might happen, gripping their rifles. They were all issued a certain number of rounds in preparation for this hairy journey. And now the S has hit the F, my friend.
Yes, very much so. And there's a merchant named Richard Fisher. He is doing business with a sea captain from Spain, a Spanish guy. They're watching these rioters on the second floor of Fisher's business. And the sea captain says, "You seem much agitated. This is nothing. We frequently have these things in Spain." To which Fisher replies, "In Spain, this might mean nothing. In America, it means civil war." And he was correct, because this situation, as we said, this situation is turned terrible very, very quickly. The columns are moving forward, trying to get to the station. They are surrounded on all sides by this howling mob of people shouting racial epithets of a very specific time and threatening their lives. "We are going to kill you before you reach the station."
They call them white N-words. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to put that out there. I'd never heard that one before. That's outrageous. It just goes to show, like, again, my notion of the ideology of Baltimore, way off, Ben, did not know about any of this stuff. The soldiers fired back. The rioters fired on the soldiers. Right. Stray bullets are flying everywhere. Mm-hmm. Paving stones are hitting people in the face. It is an absolute shit show, my friend. And they did finally make it to Camden Station, but not without some casualties. And these casualties would be considered some of the first of the Civil War. I heard somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 to 11 of these assembled lunatic rioters, a bystander who was a child, I believe, who caught like a ship cabin boy who caught a bullet in the gut, a stray bullet.
Which is an ugly way to die.
That's
and slow.
Reservoir Dogs, have you seen that? Mm-hmm. With Tim Roth? That's no good. Yeah. And 24 soldiers and an unknown number of civilians, according to a report from NPS.gov.
And on the other side, with the soldiers, 4 died. There were 4 casualties. 36 soldiers were in some way wounded. And we don't have the exact accounts of the degree of damage they received. So, one guy obviously lost his thumb. That's a tremendous bummer. But there may have been people who were just slightly wounded, you know?
Yeah, there's no real record of, like, how many people just had to hobble off to get, triaged.
Right. And there may have been people who were rendered useless in the war effort. But that is the riot in a nutshell. Why are we talking about this riot? Why are we talking about the 6th Massachusetts Infantry, this change of trains? We're talking about it because one of the people who died was the friend of a journalist and poet named James Ryder Randall, also a resident of Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah, and I think he originally came from Louisiana, so he was already super entrenched in the idea of owning slaves and that Southern ideology that was such a huge part of this divide.
It was originally just a poem. It became a song when it was set to music to the tune of the German O Tannenbaum, or Lauriger Horatius, by Jenny Carey, who is the sister of Hetty Carey. And we had a cool note from our pal Christopher, who says that Hetty Carey could be, quote, sort of, kind of, considered the Confederate Betsy Ross.
Right, because she designed the Confederate flag.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also was married to a guy whose last name was Pegram. That's weird.
Yeah. And you notice Casey is never in the same room when we mention that guy?
Yeah, well, this is the first time.
Yeah, but technically that means he's never been in the same room.
Well, technically he's never in the same room because we're in the shipping container and he's out in the real world.
We're in a partition of a room.
Okay, that's fair.
But what makes a room? That's a story for a different day. So the song, this Maryland State song is
Maryland, my Maryland?
Yeah, is the equivalent of a diss track today. And we can see through the lyrics that They're clearly, you know, the mention of a Titan clearly referring to Abraham Lincoln. Northern scum is clearly referring to the Union.
Yeah, the invading horde.
Right. And Randall himself wrote this as a protest poem, but did not originally plan for it to become a state song. He was also known as the Poet Laureate of the Lost Cause.
Oh, that's like that sounds like a very backhanded compliment.
It feels very emo to me.
I know.
It's like the album name for an unreleased Bright Eyes track.
I like it.
Yeah. So this song remains a protest song. It's not the official state song yet, and we'll get to when that happens, but Maryland is not all of a sudden cowed by the Union just because this one riot occurred. Right? As a matter of fact, they doubled down, I believe.
Yeah, it didn't beat them down right away, but the effects were pretty definitive. The governor and the mayor that we talked about earlier called out for militia forces to come in and keep the peace in the streets. And then a little later, in June of 1861, Maryland did in fact vote to secede from the Union. But by that time, essentially, because of their actions in this riot, Maryland was occupied by Union forces.
Yeah, which is weird because according to a couple of different articles, one by Michael Dresser over at the Baltimore Sun, originally after the riot to quell tensions, Lincoln himself had promised that they wouldn't do that. And then that's exactly what they did.
Yeah. Can you fill in the gaps there for me a little bit? I was kind of having a hard time wrapping my head around what happened. It looks like they had these militia forces. They were trying to keep the peace, but there was a threat made against a fort, a Union fort.
Yeah, Fort McHenry. So Fort McHenry, in the aftermath of the riot, becomes incredibly important. Like in July, the very next month, there's a grand jury that's already indicting several people for their role in the riot. After the riot, there are still skirmishes occurring between just the local police and citizens. And Mayor Brown and Governor Hicks, as you said, asked Lincoln to please don't send any more troops through our town. This is bad for everybody. It's a lose-lose. And he said a couple of different conflicting things. It was at a peace delegation who was speaking at a YMCA meeting, true story. And he said that, you know, no matter what people say about it, Union soldiers were neither birds to fly over Maryland nor moles to burrow under it. So Hicks, the governor, authorized the mayor to send the militia, you know, mention the militias, to disable the railroad bridges into the city. He said he didn't do it, but the stories differ. And Fort McHenry, in this crazy will-they-won't-they debate over putting Union soldiers in there, Fort McHenry becomes a place for the Union forces to detain people. There's a newspaper editor who gets detained. There is a man who was supposed to be a Maryland militia state soldier was detained, and the legal system is getting involved. And Fort McHenry becomes this sort of center for the Union forces and quite controversial.
Yes. And the reason that the occupation of Maryland really kicked off was that Fort McHenry was under attack by some secessionists, and one of these militia units was sent to help out with that. And then the commander in charge, General Butler, of the same unit of troops that had come into Baltimore in the first place during the riot,
the Sixth Massachusetts,
Yeah, he kind of knew, based on previous events, that there were secessionists in the ranks of these militiamen and agreed to accept their assistance, but didn't really want them to get too close.
Didn't want them to get too close.
He said if they did get any closer, then there was like a chapel that was a mile and a half from the fort, then they would unleash gunfire upon them.
And again, we find ourselves in an untenable, unsustainable situation. A city largely divided and separate from, in many ways, the aims of the federal government. However, as you can tell, despite the precarious nature of the state, city, and federal government relationship, ultimately, many of the very, very extremely pro-Confederate Baltimoreans and civil leaders, they leave town.
Right.
They go south. And
not on a rail, because they had already pried up all the rails, right?
Right. And they eventually, about 60,000 Marylanders end up fighting for the Union, and only about 20 to 25,000 end up fighting for the Confederacy.
Yeah, because that's one thing that we didn't really talk about. A lot of places I read, there was kind of a split in Maryland because it was below the Mason-Dixon line. So it was, they did have this kind of sense of themselves as being more a part of the South. They depended on slavery for commerce with the tobacco and it being sort of a hub for trade. Mm-hmm. But it was a little more divided than maybe initially seemed to be the case.
Yeah, many places were pretty divided and not ideologically homogenous.
Because here's the thing, who's going to take to the streets and, you know, put themselves life and limb in harm's way? It's not the casual racists, you know.
Right.
It's the hardcore ones, the real zealots, the ones that would probably go on to cut bait, leave town, go fight for their cause.
Right, right. And here's one fact that many people may miss when we hear the story, because, of course, the riot is the huge big tent item, right? But later that year, on September 17th, 1861, when the legislature reconvened to discuss the riot, the aftermath of the riot, and what could be construed as unconstitutional actions on the part of the U.S. president, on that day, 27 state legislatures, that is one-third of the General Assembly, were arrested and jailed by the feds because Lincoln, you see, had suspended habeas corpus and—
Habeas corpus being like rules of engagement kind of stuff?
Habeas corpus is the way a person can legally report unlawful detention or imprisonment. It's ordering someone to bring a detained person to a court to determine whether it's legal to keep them in jail.
Got it.
So suspending habeas corpus means we could just throw you in jail.
Sort of like how we do with, you know, Guantanamo Bay and stuff.
History is much more of a circle than a straight line. So because they arrested so many people at once, the legislative session was canceled, and Maryland could not continue debating secession or anti-war movements.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that they were already under Union control.
Absolutely.
But as we said before, a lot of those zealots decided to take off and go fight for the Confederacy. One of them, surprise, surprise, was the guy who wrote that poem.
No way.
Yeah, James Ryder Randall. He took off and went to Georgia. And there's a really great quote in this article from NPR, "Maryland gets closer to retiring state song that calls Northerners scum," that kind of sums up Maryland's position in the war in general from their state archives. It described it as walking a tightrope between the Union and the Confederacy. In addition to being physically between the two sides, Maryland depended equally on the North and the South for its economy. Although Maryland had always leaned toward the South culturally, sympathies in the state were as much pro-Union as they were pro-Confederate.
And now let's use our fast-forward buttons just a bit. The song, which exists for decades afterwards as a very popular protest song in some circles, becomes the official state song of Maryland in 1939 and remained so until this year, until just a few months ago as we record this. In March of 2018, state senators approved a bill that would strip Maryland, My Maryland of its designation as the official state song and rebrands this pro-Confederate anthem as an historical tune.
Yeah, kind of a demotion, I guess.
Yeah.
Which makes sense in the cultural moment that we're having with racist monuments.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're getting covered up, getting pulled down by the people, you know?
Here
in Georgia,
cases,
we got a lot of that going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And some still remain today. Because to paraphrase William Faulkner, history is not over. It's not even the past yet, you know? And interesting point there, Noel. 1939, That was the same year Gone with the Wind was released.
Oof.
So I wonder if culturally there was an impetus to tap into that romanticized picture of antebellum South.
Yeah, it's funny. In a place, Athens, Georgia, you may know from its place in the music industry with REM and the B-52s and all that. I lived there for a while, and there are a few Confederate monuments there. And somebody, it being kind of a hipster college town, some clever devil put up a sign on one of the monuments saying second place. you know, that's implying great. That the Confederates, they lost the war. So why do we need monuments? Some people say it's heritage. It's you know, memorializing our history rather than these negative ideas. You know, there's an argument to be made for that, I suppose. But I think there's probably better ways of doing it than having giant obelisks in the middle of intersections.
Right. And there's also a lot of interesting stuff we won't have time for today regarding the plagiarization of melodies in state songs, the weird in-between status that a lot of state songs occupy. Like, there are other state songs that have used the melody of O Tannenbaum, right? There are other state songs that for a while had derogatory things, or at least at the very least implications and allusions inherent in the verse. And at this point, as Maryland moves this song from an official status to a slightly less prestigious historical status, we have to ask ourselves how many of these vestiges remain. Statues, as you said, Noel, obelisk, songs. I mean, hopefully there's not like a racist state bird or something. So we want to hear from you, whether you are in the U.S. or abroad. What is a silly official thing about your state or country, and where did it come from?
Yeah, and, you know, Confederate monuments, affirm or against them.
And if so, why or why not?
Exactly. You can write to us at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. You can catch us on the social medias, or we are Ridiculous History on Facebook and Instagram. You can check out our Facebook group, The Ridiculous Historians, where there's always fun stuff popping off.
Oh, and let me check. We're almost there. As we were going into the studio today, we were on pins and needles, or at least I was, to see when we get our 1,000th member of Ridiculous Historians. And right now, as we're closing, we're at 995.
Oh, man.
We're so close.
It's fine.
We were texting about this this all day. But if you're
all day?
If you're already on this group, we appreciate it. And I'm especially enjoying all the hilarious memes and dives into history and the fantastic stories we're reading.
It is a lot of fun. So check us out there and leave us a nice review on iTunes. We appreciate that too. And please join us next time when we talk about a particular baseball game, a no-hitter, in fact, that was done while on some psychedelic drugs.
No spoilers. Tune in and we'll talk to you very soon.
See you then.